today is February 8th, and I am back with Bill Weiss in his office for the second of his Pew interviews. I was looking or reviewing the tapes yesterday, and one thing popped out that we kind of glossed over, and I'd like to go back to it, and that is you said you spent some time in Paris.
Oh, that was just part of when we did that experiment in Wayne's lab. At the time, there were very few synchrotrons in the world that could do this tunable wavelength experiment, and the particular characteristics of that synchrotron and the particular beam line there allowed us to do it, and that's why we went there. It wasn't anything beyond that. And it's at the University of Paris. It's actually right outside of Paris. And I spent a month working there, and I got into Paris, I think, twice the entire time.
No.
As I said, working at a synchrotron will take the romance out of Paris.
that's
yeah.
too bad.
Yeah, I mean, I've been there before, and I love the place, but that was definitely a working trip.
Okay.
Right. It wasn't too romantic.
Darn.
Darn, yeah, exactly.
Okay. Let's go ahead. I think yesterday we finished talking about your postdoc, pretty much. So let's move on, and maybe you can tell me the circumstances around you ending up at Stanford.
Oh, right. Well, let's see. As I said, I really love working in New York, and I wasn't actually, at the time, even thinking about looking for a job. And what happened was that I had been there. I have to think about the dates for a minute. I guess I had been there for a little over 2 years, just about 2 years, and my friend John Kurnian at the Rockefeller had gotten one of these Dear Colleague letters soliciting jobs at UCSF. And John knew I liked the Bay Area, and you know, it was a good job, so he said, you know, you really should apply for it. And I said, well, you know, I'm not sure I'm really ready. I'm not thinking about it yet. And he said, just do it, you know, because I thought about it and said, well, this is a great opportunity. How often do jobs at places like that come up? And, of course, once you commit to doing something like that, you actually have to be kind of serious. So what happened was that I was really lucky. Basically, it turned out that both UCSF was advertising. Turned out that this department was Stanford, which was called Cell Biology then, and Johns Hopkins, the biophysics department at Johns Hopkins Medical School, also was looking for someone, and it turned out Berkeley was conducting a search too, so the three schools in the Bay Area were looking. Now, the Berkeley one had actually closed, but I sort of made some inquiries, and it turned out, you know, they said, oh, come out, we'd like to see you. So I came out, so I went to Hopkins, I came down here, you know, interviewed, and it came out to the three schools here, interviewed all of them, and then I also got contacted, I think once these things start happening, people talk, and so I was contacted by Ian Wilson at Scripps, and I went out there, and, you know, interviewed, and then Sloan Kettering came up, same kind of thing, I was contacted by them. So I think that's the total list of six places. And if you think about it, that's incredibly lucky because these are six really good places. I didn't have to, I wasn't even sort of looking. Seriously, so I didn't feel any pressure. So it was almost the ideal circumstance. So I really had it easy, in other words. I didn't have to apply to 100 places. And I figured, great, these are all really competitive. If I don't get them, I'll do it seriously next year or whenever I'm ready. And the timing was great because I actually hadn't published at that time anything, my postdoc, although the work was done, we were writing it up, so it was all new and fresh, and no one had heard about it, so it was just absolute fantastically fortuitous timing to present this work, and it was all very new, and it was a lot of new methodology as well as the new structure. So I got offers at actually all of them except Berkeley and UCSF, and I wound up coming here. So it was kind of very lucky and not stressful. I had one of the luckiest times in terms of looking for a job because it just fell out that way. And then what happened was the really agonizing thing came after I had these offers, which was that I really wasn't sure I wanted to leave New York for various reasons, and I really agonized very hard about going to Sloan Kettering. And it was a very different opportunity because there I would have been the first structural biologist, or first crystallographer, I should say. They had recruited an NMR person from Columbia already. And I would have been faced with, you know, basically designing and setting up a whole lab from scratch, which I wasn't really averse to doing, but I'm also, it's not something I particularly wanted to do. You know, some people really want to be the first and sort of have it all under their power, and I just wasn't that keen to do it one way or the other. Here, Dave McKay was already here. There was a functional X-ray lab, and I could add to it. And I sort of really agonized over it for about 5 months and drove both places crazy, I'm sure. but in the end, I decided to come here, which I certainly don't regret. I mean, in retrospect, it was really the right thing to do.
How did you know you liked the Bay Area? Had you been out
here?
Yeah,
I had been out here. I had my best friend from college had moved up from Southern California to Genentech about a year before all this happened. So he was out here, and I would visit. And I had a lot of friends turned out doing postdocs at UCSF and Stanford. So I knew the general area, and I knew I liked it. Yeah, those kind of...
That's great. Yeah. Wow.
No, it was lucky. And the other thing is that I knew myself, I really was very much, I really wanted to stay in one of those two areas, and particularly at a minimum on one of the two coasts. I really didn't want to live off of one of the two coasts. So that played into it also. And so when all these opportunities came up, it would have been stupid for me not to. Although I could imagine myself being that stupid without friends kind of kicking me, but that's really what happened.
Okay. Well, what a nice place to wind up.
Oh yeah. No, as I said, it's been it's been really really good on the whole. I mean, all these things have ups and downs with starting out on a faculty, of course, but I have no complaints.
You also said that yesterday that postdoc was really like the best years of
your life. No doubt about it.
And I've actually heard that from a few people, although not everybody realizes it while they're going through it. But I've heard a number of the scholars say that you go from that, which is the very best time of your life, into being junior faculty, which is absolutely the worst time of your life. Was that your experience? Or
it was... I guess enough of my friends had gone through it, so I had some idea what to expect. But there are things that I think different people react to differently. So I came here, so our department when I came here was really in bad shape, it turned out, and people were actually surprised I stayed as long as I did. Some of my colleagues on the departments were actually surprised I stayed, because there was a couple of senior faculty left the department in the year between when I accepted the job and when I came here, and the department was pretty much in financial deep straits, bordering on dysfunctional. But I actually felt it was an advantage because our department just didn't have the kind of nonsensical responsibilities that most departments dump on their junior faculty. We teach medical histology, which is a funny thing for us to be teaching, but we do. But I only do 3 lectures a year, and they ease me into that 1 lecture a year. Dave and I have taught a graduate course in crystallography every couple of years, but I didn't have to do that for the first 2 years. So I had very few teaching responsibilities. We have very few students, so I had none of the sort of committee-type responsibilities for students, although I did actually was our department representative for the admissions, but it's not a big chore. So I just didn't have a lot of the kind of stuff, you know, student oral exams and the like that are a drag on your time. And, of course, the other big thing junior faculty run into, of course, is having to do grants. And I was very lucky because, as I said yesterday, I was able to take this project with me, which was kind of, something I knew was going to work. And, of course, with the conservatism of the NIH, I knew it would probably be a fundable project because, you know, it was something that we already had proven could work, and we were going to do the next things, which were really interesting and exciting projects, but also conservative in the sense that there was a pretty good chance that it was going to work. So I wasn't ultimately that worried about getting it funded. Mm-hmm. So I wrote an NIH grant when I came here, and I got it funded. And that was a bit of a worry, because that was the absolute nadir of the funding at the NIH. It was 92, 93, right? Uh-huh. So this was the really bottom time, but it got a really high score and it got funded, so I was kind of off. And I had a very generous startup here as well to start up new projects. So I never really had the kind of money problem. Yeah, I worried about it until it takes a year to actually see the money when you write a grant, but that came through relatively quickly. So after a year, I was set. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing, which of course no one is prepared for and nothing prepares you for, is the personnel management.
Yeah.
And that's by and large worked out pretty well. I think I run the lab in a very kind of informal way. I just kind of go around and talk to people. I don't have a very formal structure to it. And we just interact and it's fine. And I've had, with one major exception, just great people. Mm-hmm. So sort of a lot of the things that wind up being a drag on junior faculty just, you know, I was able to avoid to a large extent, actually. So I feel even, and I think part of it really was the sort of situation of the department. It actually wound up working in my favor. Mm-hmm. And Dave McKay, my colleague, was really great in terms of helping me set up and being very supportive helping with some resources and the like at the beginning. Mm-hmm. So, in the end, it was a pretty easy situation for me. Nonetheless, I think what has happened over the years, and the reason I still maintain that was the postdoc is the best time of my life, because it's really the only time when you have no responsibility aside from doing research. Mm-hmm. You don't have money worries, you don't have worries about writing a thesis or being a TA. Mm-hmm. And from that point of view, you're just totally focused. Mm-hmm. With no other distractions. And the thing I know I don't have is good time management skills. And, I need to focus. I can't sort of work on five things in a day, and I really need to focus. And that's what I found very frustrating, and I've sort of had to come to accept it. And I've just had to sacrifice certain things. I don't do bench work anymore. I still can do, fortunately, because of what the nature of our work with structural biology is a lot of computation and instrumentation work, and I can still do that. And I go to the synchrotron with the lab, and I can collect data and get out of my office, and that's great. But I have had to sacrifice a certain amount of the wet biochemistry, which takes 10 or 12-hour blocks of time, and I don't have that. Mm-hmm. But I've just come to accept that, and it's not that big a deal, because I'm still very much involved with the projects in a hands-on way.
So you had said yesterday that you weren't that crazy about the bench work anyway.
No, I actually like it. I just found it boring full time. Not what I said. I mean, what I meant was that it really was a case where I couldn't imagine doing it, because it does get very repetitive. Uh-huh. But doing it along with what I like in doing crystallography, in fact, is that you don't do anything all the time. Mm-hmm. You do some computation, some instrumentation, some bench work, and I think that's why I like it so much. Mm-hmm. Because doing any one of those would definitely bore me. But the fact that it's broken up this way is one of the real attractions of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but no, I mean, it's true. I mean, I really would like to be able to participate more actively in the wet bench stuff to some extent. It's just I'm realistic. I can't do that. Mm-hmm. That's something I've just had to sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And that gets into having a big or a small lab. And, I've always wanted to keep a very hands-on lab, and it's grown slowly but steadily. I'm now at 10. I'm not sure I want to get any bigger, because I think there is a point you cross over to being a full-time manager, and I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. And I'm probably stretching myself. I know I'm stretched too thin right now, but I'm so interested in the projects we're doing. I also need to keep enough personnel on them to keep them going. Mm-hmm. And the problem is you need critical mass. If one person leaves or doesn't work out, the whole thing falls apart. So you need to. It's a hard balance, and I don't think I've never been comfortable with it, with the balance. Yeah, I don't know what the right thing is, so I'm just kind of oscillate, but it's, this size seems to be manageable right now. Mm-hmm. I'm still enjoying it, so.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I want to talk about your lab a little bit, but I just have a quick question before that. Are you on the medical school faculty?
Yes.
Okay.
This is the medical school.
Okay.
And in fact, when I look for jobs, with the exception of Berkeley, I only applied to medical schools. And it was simple. I knew that I don't actually mind teaching, but I also don't want to do a half-assed job of it, and I know to do that is take mm-hmm. some real-time commitment. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to do that because I wanted to basically stay as a hands-on person, mm-hmm. and I knew it would be very frustrating. So I wanted PhDs in medical schools tend to do much less teaching. The quid pro quo is that we raise much more salary from our grants. Mm-hmm. We don't get a nine-month salary. I was willing to accept that. I'd rather do the research and have to raise more of my salary from grants. Mm-hmm. And that's just a choice everyone has to make. But I knew I wanted that, so, yeah.
Okay, so I'm trying to decide which direction to go in. Actually, before we talk about your lab, let's talk about these sort of PI responsibilities, which you mentioned briefly, I want to go into each one in a little more detail. And since we're talking about teaching, let's talk about that first. Actually, I don't know if you ever got a chance to look at the materials from the Pew that are about you, like your letters of recommendation, but I
no, did. I'm assuming they're confidential. I wouldn't have even thought to ask. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't, but...
Anyway, they're all very complimentary. But one of the things that, or maybe this was on your resume, I'm not sure which, that you got a certificate of distinction in teaching.
When I was a graduate student, when I TA'd undergraduate biochemistry. Uh-huh. It was just a thing, you know, if the students gave you a good recommendation, you get a little certificate from the school. It wasn't any big thing.
But a couple of the people that wrote about you said that they thought you would be a good teacher. So tell me a little bit. You said you'd only teach three lectures a year
for our medical course. I teach graduate. Yeah. Uh-huh. No, I've actually taken on much more teaching since I started, of course. But my teaching falls into a couple of different things. Our department collectively teaches first year medical histology, which is kind of a funny historical burden of the department. None of us are ultimately qualified to really be teaching. It's very basic cell biology, and we try to relate tissue structure to, you know, down to molecules, and it's very much a basic science course. Mm-hmm. It's run by a fantastic Pat Cross, who's a professor of teaching in our department. She actually runs the course, and she's wonderful. Without her, it would fall apart. I mean, I can tell you that. And she makes it very easy for us because basically there are good medical TAs. Basically, the format is we lecture for an hour, and then there are two hours of lab after that. And she and the TAs run the lab. Mm-hmm. They take care of the exams and the like. So all we really have to do is lecture. And I actually have really enjoyed it. And the reason is that it's funny because I've learned new things. See, I think the best thing about teaching is that you learn. So I came in and they said, okay, you're teaching the ear. Okay, I know nothing about the ear. Yeah. But I learned it, and it's incredibly interesting. It really is. And I teach skin, the skin and the eye. Okay. Now, it turns out the skin has turned out to be unbelievably useful because most of my lab works on cell adhesion. Mm-hmm. And it's just directly relevant to things we do. And now I can pick up journals and look at histological sections and see what's going on. Mm-hmm. So it's actually, that one's turned out to be incredibly practical. And, you know, and I really enjoy that one for that reason. And then we're doing some stuff related to some stuff very indirectly in the eye with some receptors, and so, you know, that, and of course I worked on rhodopsin and eye work as an undergrad, so I had some familiarity with part of it. And it turns out with the ear and the eye, both of them, we teach tissue structure and how, you know, the eye functions as an optical element or the ear functions to transduce sound waves. So there's some very basic physics, which of course, doing the kind of thing we do, you know, I can kind of explicate mm-hmm. that. You know, remind kids of their freshman physics, which they all hate, of course. So actually, I really do enjoy doing those lectures because they're just absolutely fascinating. And, you know, they're incredibly painful to get together the first time. It's 2.5-3 weeks of solid work. Sure. But I do it seriously. But that's the point. I mean, I actually enjoy doing it, but the time commitment is such that I think with all the other pressures, I wouldn't want to do a lot of it.
Right.
But I do, as I said, I actually do enjoy doing those. Then Dave and I have taught every other year a course in crystallography and diffraction mm-hmm. methods, which is kind of bread and butter stuff. And it's mm-hmm. found it useful because, you know, to sort of actually have to explain to people who don't really know it stuff that you don't even think about anymore.
Right.
That's a very useful thing to have to articulate stuff, even stuff you think you know, and you realize you don't know it at a level you can truly articulate it in a simple way. It's a real challenge, and I think it's very actually good for your own understanding. Mm-hmm. And I found that was when I taught as a graduate student too. I taught physical chemistry for 2 years, TA'd that, and you know, actually having to explain thermodynamics to people who can't do math, say, is very good.
Yeah.
So in that sense, it's very helpful. What's happened more recently is that there's a movement among many of us in the basic sciences, this is over many departments, to revamp the graduate curriculum. We're trying to decide, you know, figure out, sort of settled on the areas that all graduate students should know, regardless of their particular discipline. And part of that is structural biology and very basic physical biochemistry. So I, with Dave, Jody Puglisi in my department, and Dan Hirschlag in biochemistry, we put a new course together which combines elements of the course Dave and I taught on protein structure with enzymology and kinetics that Dan Hirschlag taught, and Rick Aldrich and Rich Lewis from another department have, from MCP, have been lecturing on diffusion and cooperativity and the like, things that they're really expert in. That's turned out to be, mm-hmm. we did it for the first time last year, mm-hmm. and we got a really good response, and we're trying to integrate this into a kind of core curriculum. So I've wound up taking on a lot of teaching to do that. And mm-hmm. of course, then when Jody Puglisi arrived in our department, we reorganized this methods course, and we're now teaching this every other year, this biophysical methods, which is basically crystallography and NMR. Mm-hmm. So I've been fairly involved, certainly relative to most of my colleagues in the department, you know, a fair amount of teaching in that, partly because I just believe we should be doing a certain amount. You know, I mean, we are professors.
It is, again, all a teaching institution.
Right. No, as I said, I just think the reality is that the time pressures that are brought to bear on you are mm-hmm. such. And I think the people I really do have more true sympathy for are the junior faculty, and not here necessarily, but just generally who I've talked to in arts and sciences places where, you know, and we all know this, I mean, the junior faculty come and they get dumped teaching these very low-level undergrad courses with a huge number of students, and the time commitment is immense. And it strikes me that, you know, that's something that more established senior colleagues really should be taking on more of a responsibility, because we have so many other, you know, junior faculty have a lot of headaches getting used to the whole idea of running a lab, doing grants, mm-hmm. Personnel management, that I think to get that additional burden dumped on them, and I'm sure you've probably heard this from other colleagues, I think is really kind of unfair. And I think it would be nice if, just because that's the way it was in the past when the senior people were doing it, I mean, it would be nice to break that cycle. Mm-hmm. I'm not complaining, because personally I've been, you know, satisfied with the responsibilities I've had for teaching, but I do think mm-hmm. that's an issue. That, and I know people talk about this in other universities, mm-hmm. and I think it's a legitimate issue. Mm-hmm. Should be addressed.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the course that you've taught, you know, the histology,
yeah.
which you've taught a few years in a row now,
seven.
Six. is there much prep time for that anymore?
No,
that's
no,
pretty
no,
much in
point.
The can.
Yeah, they're relatively canned lectures, but mm-hmm. what I do to keep it, actually more to keep it interesting for me, and you know, for some students, you know, I do keep up with things, particularly with the skin. It's easy because I actually do read the mm-hmm. literature. If there are really new, interesting things, what's happened, particularly in the ear and the eye, in the ear particularly, there's been this explosion in the last 2 years of finding genes that control hereditary deafness, which is of real interest to the students because it's clinically relevant, and it turns out to illuminate a lot of the mechanisms we talk about. So I do try to, you know, I do actually keep up with that. So, and it keeps it interesting for me.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
It definitely does. It's starting to get a bit stale, I have to admit, and, you know, mm-hmm. I'll look forward to a sabbatical year, you know, but basically I do enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people say that students have changed. That's a sure sign that you're getting older.
Yeah, right, that's
you know,
right.
When you say yeah. that. But what is your experience of the students? And this is a very high-powered
right.
university, so.
Right. The students here, I've been very impressed with. I mean, they're certainly, they're certainly up to the level, you know, of, I'd say on average, I don't actually see that much of a change, to be honest. I think this mm-hmm. always, you know, wishful, you know, mushy thinking about the past, you know. What I do find is that in our area, there are fewer... When I went into structural biology, it wasn't a very sexy thing to do. And people who went into it, a lot of them were kind of really from very hardcore physical backgrounds. And as it become a more, as it's become a more sexy biological area, you have people coming into it now who don't have the quantitative backgrounds that we used mm-hmm. to. They have a better biological background. And because the methodology's improved to the point where you don't need that, they can do very successful work in it. So in our little narrow area, I see that the students coming in don't have the stronger, the strongest backgrounds anymore, mm-hmm. quantitatively. But I think part of it is it's also just times have changed. I mean, I don't think it matters that when I was in grad school, you know, DNA sequencing was four or five years old. Okay, it was mm-hmm. a big deal. You know, a mm-hmm. thesis would be to clone a gene. Mm-hmm. And the fact is things have progressed, and you can do all this stuff with kits, and you can say, well, it's really a shame that students don't understand how the kits work, and I'm not defending that. I think everyone should. But there are just new frontiers and new problems, mm-hmm. New methodologies that come up, and the fact that that stuff is now old hat, who cares? You know? So mm-hmm. I actually don't have a problem with it, and if that's the level of objection, I don't know. Now, you know, a fair question is, okay, well, how many people are really, you know, the sort of super creative types, and are you seeing fewer of those? And I'm not so sure that it's ever been, I think there always will be and always have been, the sort of this absolute upper tier of outstanding students that come along, you know, if you're lucky, once in a class or once in every two classes, and everyone else, you know, is going to be really solid and do good work. And I'm not so sure the average has changed, to be mm-hmm. honest. I mean, maybe I'm just not old enough to you know have the perspective, but I'm just not so sure. Mm-hmm. I think what has changed in part is the you know the culture a little bit in that in our field actually was one of the major attractions of it to me. Frankly, was that it wasn't very competitive when mm-hmm. I started it. There were very few people doing it. It was hard. And you could stake out, okay, I have crystals of something, and you stake out, and it would take 5 years to do a structure. And now it's super competitive. It's gotten as bad as molecular biology. We've gotten beaten on a few projects, and it's super competitive, and you can now, you know, we've solved structures in as fast as a week in good cases. Generally, that doesn't happen, you know, but, you know, it's happened. Mm-hmm. It's also taken us 4 or 5 years in some. And I think that level of competition has changed, and it attracts a different kind of person. Because when I started in it, you know, you would never people who wanted. I had my friend who used to be at Genentech actually. You know, he said I could never do what you were doing because I have to have feedback every 10 days. I need to have a success. You know, if I'm cloning, you know, I need to see that sort of intermediate tangible project progress. And we don't have that. You know, in us, it's you get one thing at the end of the day. Do you have a structure or not?
Yeah.
And when I started in it, that was 4 or 5 years down the road, and you just had to have the faith that you were going to do it. Mm-hmm. It's a different kind of personality, and I think in my little area, the kind of personality is mm-hmm. You have a much more typical kind of, you know, short-term gratification type personality mm-hmm. than you might have when I was in grad school. But going back to the more general question of students in generally in the biomedical sciences different, maybe the only other thing that's changed is that because the options, I suppose, are greater, it's now much, maybe somewhat more like chemistry students, where not everyone is intending to go into academics and do super creative work, but they want to go into industry and maybe have a less, you know, more structured 9-to-5 type thing. Mm-hmm. Although I'm not all biotech is certainly like that. A lot of mm-hmm. it's much more like academia. But I think there are more options, and maybe it's attracting more students who are more interested in a more sort of basic kind of, you know, I want to be technically trained and do a career in this, but not sort of be an academic and doing mm-hmm. that kind of cutting edge. Mm-hmm. So maybe the kind of student in the latter category have gotten diluted a little bit. I suppose that may have happened. Mm-hmm. but because I think, I think the general pool of students, this is numerically, has probably expanded. And I think there was a time when times were really tough, and I think it still has the reputation of being very tough, that it's a hard road to hoe. I mean, grants are super competitive, and it's, you know, there's no question a lot of the best students still go into medicine or law or whatever, you know, really bright people are doing those things, and you know, all of us, you know, at some level probably bemoan that, you know, are we always getting the best, potentially the best students? But of course, a lot of success in science, as I've said, it's mindset, it's not raw talent. So, you know, I don't know. I'm not so sure it's changed that much. Maybe the pool's gotten a little diluted. And there are more good places. So maybe when you talk to people at really good places, they're competing for students against many more places, and there are just more options. So in any one institution, it could be that the pool of the best students has gotten diluted that way, because there are just more options now than there were 10 or 15 years ago. In terms of, you know, quote, elite institutions.
Well, one of the things that I've heard a lot of people say, and I know it was my experience teaching, is that the students argue about grades and things things that I never would have thought of doing when I was a student. Does that happen here, or are they more?
Well, I'm really insulated from that because I don't teach undergraduates, and we don't deal with the medical students. I think, in fact, our course is probably pass-fail. I don't even know, but Pat takes care of all that. So, certainly at the graduate level, none of the students care. So, in that sense, the only thing they care about, you know, the school requires they carry a, you know, B or B plus average or something. So, they'll care if they're flunking, but. They couldn't care less. And I tell them, look, I've never been asked for my graduate school transcript. I don't even know where my diploma is. So, I mean, you know, it's kind of, that's not what matters at this level. And I think students do know that. Frankly, I doubt it's changed with undergraduates, despite what everyone says, because, you know, I think what happens is that when we were students, we probably cared less about grades, and then people now who are teaching undergraduates who never cared about grades, and now they're facing the undergrads who do care about grades from medical school, or just facing it and say, oh, it's terrible, it wasn't like this when I was a student. But I bet it was. They just, it was their peers doing it, and they just didn't care. You know, they didn't know. Because, look, when I was a biochemistry major in college, and most of them were going to medical school, and of course they were worried about their grades. I know that. I don't think it was any different. And I talked to my, you know, I was friendly with a lot of professors and graduate students when I was an undergrad, and they would complain about it. I doubt it's changed. I don't believe that.
Okay. In terms of, since this is a private university as opposed to a public, what's the distribution on campus of ethnicities and gender?
Yeah, well, again, I really don't have exposure to the undergrad campus. I think this is certainly a, I'm sure it's whiter and generally more upper middle class than a public university. I'm sure that's true. But I really statistically have no idea. The medical school, it's hard to know. I mean, I know there's a very active and very effective recruiting program for underrepresented minorities. But curiously, my sense, and I may be completely off base here, not being a doctor, my sense, though, is that this is not a great medical school to come to if you want to be a practicing physician rather than someone who's a little more academically oriented. You know, there's some very high fraction of the medical students who do research here. I don't know, it's like 25% or something that I found, some number which I found truly astounding. It attracts that kind of, it's a more academically oriented medical school. And, you know, let's face it, if you're working ER here, you're not going to get the kind of spectrum of patients that you get in an inner city hospital. It's just different. And if you want that kind of, you want to be that kind of doctor, this is probably not the kind of place you're going to be. And I suspect that that may affect, to some extent, the distribution you know, minority students or whatever, just because I'm not sure this is the best. If it's the kind of thing where you want to have, you know, students coming back and then going back to, let's say, you know, underrepresented minorities going back to their communities, which, you know, realistically are, you know, tend to be in you know, more urban areas, maybe this isn't the best place to come in the first place. You know? So, but I actually really may be completely off base. I, you know, I just don't know. But that's kind of my gut sense, you know, looking around and talking to, you know, some people. At the graduate level, I think we don't do as well as public universities, and I'm getting hit with this right now, having just taken over a training grant in biophysics. And I know, you know, we're trying to work out ways of really improving our minority recruitment, because we get only a very few, you know, qualified applicants each year. And, of course, we're competing with many places for that. And I think there is, talking to some of the people who choose not to come here, I think there is a sense that this is not as friendly a place as maybe a Berkeley, for example. And that's understandable at some level. I'm not sure it's true. I think that's a perception. I don't think that's the reality. But you know, look, Palo Alto is a white upper middle class area, and I'm sure I can understand that it's not as attractive as a more integrated kind of area than a Berkeley or a UCSF even. And that's a real frustration actually for me. Not because, you know, not just to make the grant succeed, of course, but I mean, I think. I think we do offer opportunities here for training that are unique, and I hate to lose students, any student, for a reason like that. But, you know, we do. And I'd like to improve that. But, you know, it is a struggle. That's a general concern I have that goes beyond that, though. I think well, it's something maybe you want to discuss later, because I think the whole pipeline issue of the K-12 education is really the big problem. We simply can't remedy it at this level with affirmative action or anything like that. We, you know, it really, this, the pool is far too small, and that it really has to go way back educationally, and that's something I hope I can get more involved in later on, because I think that's a far bigger problem than worrying about it at this level.
Do you see yourself doing community work?
I hope in the longer term, and I right now, my, you know, just the pressures of our work and like, we're sort of in a time where I can't do that. But I can imagine doing that in the future. I'd rather do something like that than serve on a lot of corporate boards. You know, I know that that's something that you get asked to do more, and I would much rather be doing something like that. I'm not sure what the tangible things I would do right now are, and that's just because probably I haven't worked hard to find out. But I think, and I'm hoping sort of through this training grant to sort of get more familiar with what one can do and try to, you know, I want to put some programs in place at Stanford to try to do that if I can, but more generally, you know, in the community at large, I'd like to see what can be done. And I'm not sure, you know, to be honest, because I think we're fighting a lot of cultural things. I think right now, and this is not just minorities, I actually don't think it's as much color as it is economic class. I mean, you know, people from lower economic classes, I believe there's much more community and family pressure, I'm sure, to do a profession that makes money. And getting that kind of people from that background into science is a harder thing, because this is not a profession, as I said, you go into to make money. And I think you have a double whammy going against you. And I'm not saying, maybe that doesn't matter, and maybe we have enough scientists already in the pipeline, but if we're going to worry about that and, you know, want role models, the people who've come out of lower economic classes, we have to do something about it. But how does one change the culture? And say, well, you know, gee, money isn't everything, when, of course, you know, if you're coming from a real poverty condition, it is everything, you know, to get out. It's the first thing. And, you know, my parents' generation came out of that, and, of course, they worried first and foremost about, you know, better economic and, you know, providing a future for people like me to then go and do what they want. And maybe it is a several-generation issue. And maybe we can't worry about it at this level, but, you know, and, as I said, I'm not sure there is a solution for that reason, but, you know, I think it's worth, you know, trying to think about for the future and, you know, do something about it. But I right now don't have any concrete ideas. But I want to learn more. Yeah.
Well, in terms of the less formal teaching that you do, which would be
101.
With your graduate students. You just said a second ago that you think that the training opportunities are unique here.
Yeah.
In what way?
Well, I was referring specifically to the physics-biology interface. Just what's happened here in the last few years is we've really improved the biophysics community at Stanford, and we've done it it's largely by faculty recruitments, but also we have some unique things here. We have this Linear Accelerator Center as a unique resource. We have all the people who do single molecule work, which is the big sexy area now, being able to image single molecules and their dynamics. We have Steve Chu, this Nobel laureate here, who invented optical tweezers, is in the physics department here. Steve Block just moved here from Princeton last year, and W.E. Murner came here from San Diego. We've got basically three of the biggest people who do this, really pioneered these methods. And we're seeing it in our applications, actually, in the biophysics program now. We also have a relatively small faculty and small graduate program, and we have much more personalized here than it is in larger places. But it is largely what I said is really unique to Stanford in terms of this biology physics interface, and a lot of the gene chip technology. There's just been a lot of sort of invention, physics and engineering type invention that's gone on here that is kind of unique to this place, and it's a very interactive place. One of the big reasons I came here, I realized, and I'm very happy here, is because having trained on the East Coast, and I don't know if this is Stanford or just a West Coast thing, it's just much less, certainly at the faculty level, there's just a lot less of this kind of ego and arrogance, people forcing their egos on you, and I think it's very interactive, and, I came here and I wanted to work on certain things, and I walked into some colleagues' offices and said, hey, we should collaborate on this, and it's like that. There aren't these kind of walls and fiefdoms that I found at Harvard and elsewhere that you have, and Harvard's, I think, particularly egregious that way, I just really enjoy it because I think there are just far more opportunities here for this kind of interdisciplinary interaction than it's just easier to do here, and I really try to emphasize that to students who come through, because I think that is a unique thing about Stanford, or as I said, maybe it's a West Coast thing rather than Stanford, but versus, say, Berkeley or UCSF, Stanford has one thing, which is that the medical school sits on the campus. And I think that's an enormous advantage for someone like me working in a kind of interface area between physical science and biology, that we don't have to travel across the Bay Bridge. Mm-hmm. We have the medical people here and all this great biomedical stuff going on with the physical scientists. It's wonderful. Mm-hmm. So those are the kinds of things I do feel are unique here. Mm-hmm. They've made it very attractive.
Let me flip the tape over.